fell off the side of a mountain. This was in the early spring of 1871. Haim, his brother, and three friends had set out to climb the Sentis, the 12th highest peak in Switzerland. All five men had been playing in the Alps since childhood, but none were considered experienced mountaineers. That issue was historical. Almost no one was considered an experienced mountaineer in 1871. While the first recorded climb in history was Roman Emperor Hadrian's 121 CE scamper up Mount Etna to watch the sunrise, historians date the sport to Sir Alfred Wills's 1854 summiting of the Wetterhorn. For certain, local guides had already topped that peak, but Sir Alfred was an Englishman, and it was the English who were then keeping score. Either way, Wills's conquest marked the birth of systematic mountaineering and the start of the golden age of alpinism, a decade-long stretch wherein most of the first ascents in the Alps were completed. Albert Haim, meanwhile, arrived a few years too late for the golden age. No peak-bagging exploits are credited to his name. In fact, he's not remembered for his contribution to mountaineering history. Rather, he's remembered as the point when that history took a turn for the weird. The events that earned Haim this distinction took place just above treeline, at the point where the Sentis' verdant lower flanks give way to an enormous blade of rock. By the time his party had reached the bottom edge of this massif, sunny skies had turned to heavy snow. Whiteout conditions trapped them in the middle of a rocky ledge. The way forward was down a dicey slope, steep and narrow, with cliffs on all sides. An argument broke out about what to do next, but they were underdressed and overexposed, and Haim decided to push on. Just as he lifted his leg to take a step, a gust of wind snatched his hat from his head, and Haim, without thinking about it, tried to snatch it back. The sudden motion unbalanced him, and the angle of the perch did the rest. Haim fell sideways, flipped upside down, and spun around backward. Before anyone could react, he was rocketing toward the lip of a massive cliff, no way to slow down. His ice axe was out of reach. He tried driving his head and hands into the ground, but his skull slammed into rocks, his fingers ground to pulps. Even before that pain could register, he was airborne. Haim's actual flight covered 66 feet and lasted no more than a few seconds. But that wasn't his experience. The first thing Haim noticed was that he'd dropped into another dimension. His senses were exquisitely heightened, his vision panoramic. Time had slowed to a crawl. He could see his brother and his friends and the horrified look on their faces, but, as he explained later, felt no anxiety, no trace of despair or pain. Rather, calm seriousness, profound acceptance, and a dominant mental quickness. With his life unfolding in slow motion, Haim had time to survey the territory and begin making rescue plans. He imagined scenarios for slight injuries, others for serious injuries. Where would he land? How would he bounce? And how his companions would make it down to his body? Then he realized he was never going to survive this fall and thus would be dead and unable to deliver the lecture he was supposed to give in 5 days. At Oxford University, no less. His first major Oxford lecture. He'd have to find a substitute. Then again, he'd be dead, so someone else was going to have to find a substitute. Next, he tried to take off his glasses, to protect his eyes, of course, but was unable to reach them. Instead, he said goodbye to his family and his friends, and was that heavenly music he heard? But wait, if he did survive the fall, then he probably would be stunned by the impact. Since he didn't want to go stumbling off another cliff, the first thing he needed to do was revive his senses. A few drops of vinegar on his tongue should do the trick, and on until, as he later recounted, I heard a dull thud, and my fall was over. Haim survived the impact, but the mystery never left him. Panoramic vision? Time dilation? Heavenly music? None of this made any sense. He was a scientist by training, a geologist who would go on to do fundamental work on the structure of the Alps and become a member of the Oxford Royal Society. Yet his experience seemed beyond the bounds of the rational. Not knowing what else to do, Heim conducted a survey of 32 others who had all survived near-fatal falls. A staggering 95% reported similar anomalous events. What was causing them would remain a matter of long debate, but Heim's work marks the first scientific investigation into the fact that high-risk activity can profoundly alter consciousness and significantly enhance mental abilities. Heim wrote this all up in a long essay entitled Remarks on Fatal Falls, which was published in 1892. Historians consider it the first written account of a near-death experience, but that term is misleading. Many of Heim's subjects reported these profoundly altered states without being in actual jeopardy. They only thought they were in life-threatening situations. This was a key detail. These experiences seemed mystical. If they only arose solely in dire straits, then perhaps they really were communiques from beyond the beyond. Yet, if perception and psychology were the triggers, then the puzzle was more physiological than paranormal. And that opened the door to considerably more interesting possibilities. One of the first to notice these possibilities was philosopher, physician, and psychologist William James. This was perhaps appropriate. While James taught at Harvard, he was also one of science's wilder men, an extreme sensation seeker who often ran experiments on himself. In the early 1880s, those experiments involved psychedelics, primarily nitrous oxide. But he toyed with mescaline as well. Concurrently, James had been conducting a broad survey of the world's spiritual literature, trying to come up with an accurate catalog of all possible types of mystical experiences and their psychological ramifications. He noticed that it didn't seem to matter what drug he tried or spiritual tradition he studied. All of these so-called mystical experiences seemed to share deep commonalities, all variations on the same themes that Heim reported. James also noted two more key details. The first was that these experiences were profound. People were radically different on the other side. Happier, more content, significantly more fulfilled. The results were undeniable. No matter the seemingly fantastic nature of the events, James was certain they produced changes that were undeniably psychologically real. Secondly, high-risk adventure tended to amplify not only mental performance, but physical performance as well. This discovery made James curious about the limits of human potential and led him to his famous conclusion, "Most people live in a very restricted circle of their potential being. They make use of a very small portion of their possible consciousness and of their soul's resources in general, much like a man who, out of his whole organism, should get into a habit of using and moving only his little finger." But, James critically realized, people were not doomed to stay that way. Our normal waking consciousness, rational consciousness as we call it, is but one special type of consciousness. Whilst all about it, parted from it by the flimsiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and at a touch, they are there in all their completeness. What is the requisite stimulus? Psychedelic drugs certainly provoke these experiences, as do a host of spiritual practices. But if it's truly a question of unlocking hidden abilities, James shared Heim's opinion. High-risk activity seemed the most likely path, once writing, "Great emergencies and crises show us how much greater our vital resources are than we had supposed." The work of Haim and James laid the foundation for a deeper inquiry into human potential. But it was the discovery of one of James's students, Walter Bradford Cannon, that truly changed the nature of the game. Cannon was interested in the strange physiological changes produced by powerful emotions. In all mammals, rage, anger, and fear produce an assortment of peculiarity. Heart rates speed up, pupils dilate, nostrils flare, muscles tighten, digestion ceases, senses perk and sharpen. The list goes on. Around 1916, Cannon decided these disparate reactions were actually a global response by the nervous system to extreme stress. A response with a purpose. Increase strength and stamina. Cannon had discovered the fight-or-flight response, and this rewrote the rulebook. Until then, performance enhancement had always been divine in origin. Want to write a sonnet? Talk to the muses. Want a better time in the 100-yard dash? Hermes can help. But the fight-or-flight response changed the equation, turning a gift from the gods into a byproduct of standard biology. And biology was hackable. The trail of Haim to James to Cannon went from psychology into physiology. It was a trail of mechanism. Mindset impacts emotion, which alters biology, which increases performance. Thus, it seemed, by tinkering with mindset, using everything from physical to psychological to pharmacological interventions, one could significantly enhance performance. Out of this work emerged one of history's stranger movements, the epic quest to hack ultimate human performance, a giant, global, mostly underground, often DIY, 100-plus-year effort to decode the mysteries of the zone. Adventurers, artists, academics, bohemian outcasts, maverick scientists, credentialed scientists, the psychedelic underground, paranormal researchers, the military's special forces, the Pentagon's top brass, the CEOs of major Fortune 500 companies, all got involved. Yet out of this hodgepodge, for reasons that comprise the bulk of this book, action and adventure sport athletes have become the most advanced practitioners of this art, an elite cadre of zone hackers, masters of the state now known to scientists as flow. The Way of Way. 3 weeks after returning from Asia, his ankle broken, his knee torqued, his foot still plenty sore, Danny Way has a decision to make. The 15th installment of the Summer X Games are being held in downtown Los Angeles, the mega ramp, the centerpiece of the skateboarding competition. Way had taken home the gold the previous year, but with the injuries sustained in China, no one expects him to defend his title. No one, that is, except Way himself. Way won his first contest at age 11, was twice selected as Thrasher Magazine's Skater of the Year, 5 times an X Games gold medalist, 6 times an X Games podium finisher, and 7 times a world record breaker. He remains the only skateboarder to have his name inscribed in gold in the Great Wall of China. Bomb drop 65 feet off the guitar in front of Vegas's Hard Rock Casino. Or have sideline careers in professional motocross and snowboarding. But of all the things Way's done, nothing is more impressive than his ability to triumph over injury. Danny Way single-handedly invented sports medicine for skateboarders, says Jacob Rosenberg, who directed the excellent Danny Way documentary, Waiting for Lightning. When he broke his neck, that was a career-ending injury. Athletes retired for far less. But Danny wouldn't accept that. He found his own doctors. He pioneered his own methods. Way's methods are legendary. On a number of occasions, in order to gain a better understanding of his injury, he chose to have surgery without anesthetic. Big Wave writer Chris Malloy tells a story about the time he and Wei had the exact same procedure on their knee.
"I have a pretty high threshold for pain," recounts Malloy. "I kind of enjoy seeing what I can endure. But when I got home from the hospital, I was semi-conscious, in extreme agony, about the worst I've ever felt. A few days later, I called up Danny and mentioned how grueling that was. He said, 'Yeah, the drive home was gnarly.' We had the same procedure. I was in so much pain, I kept blacking out. Danny drove himself home from the hospital."
Thus, perhaps not surprisingly, just 3 weeks after returning from China, Wei steps onto the X Games Mega Ramp launch platform and surveys the scene. His appearance sends the crowd into a tizzy. He barely notices.
"I've gotten really good at pulling the veil down," says Wei, "at camouflaging reality, locking out my conscious mind and riding my focus into the zone."
The same must be true for Jake Brown. Moments later, he kicks off the contest with a 70-foot 360 mute grab over the gap and a McTwist, an inverted backside 540 with another mute grab out of the quarter pipe. There's an electronic height meter positioned behind the ramp. At the apex of Brown's McTwist, the meter blinks 22 feet, and that's above a 27-foot quarter pipe.
So yeah, game on.
But not quite. Bob Burnquist drops in next, comes off his board midway over the gap, and goes headfirst into the landing. Typical Burnquist. Known for extremely technical tricks in extremely dangerous situations, he survives due to cat-like reflexes and seriously good karma. This time is no different. Burnquist gets his knees down at the last moment and rides the fallout on his pads. Next up is Wei. He sails cleanly over the gap, stomps the landing, and blazes into the quarter pipe. Then everything goes sideways. He soars 22 feet into the air, but drops down at a bad angle and smashes his foot on the edge of the pipe, the same foot he mangled in China. The impact re-breaks the ankle, then flips Wei upside down. He flies another 10 feet, slams hard, bounces twice, and doesn't move. The medical staff rushes over. The air sucks out of the stadium. Atop the ramp, Burnquist buries his head in his hands. Eventually, three people help Wei to his feet, but he shakes off the assistance, nearly stumbles, then drags himself to the side of the ramp. It's a brave performance, yet the announcer says what everyone is thinking.
"I don't know how in the universe Danny could come back from that."
A good question. In 1907, William James challenged psychologists to explain why certain people can draw on deep reservoirs to accomplish significantly more than others. As an example, he reflected on the idea of the second wind. Fatigue gets worse up to a certain critical point, when gradually or suddenly it passes away and we are fresher than before. We have evidently tapped a level of new energy, masked until then by the fatigue obstacle usually obeyed. There may be layer after layer of this experience. A third and a fourth wind may supervene. Mental activity shows the phenomenon as well as physical, and in exceptional cases we may find, beyond the very extremity of fatigue distress, amounts of ease and power that we never dreamed ourselves to own. Sources of strength habitually not taxed at all, because habitually we never push through the obstruction, never pass those early critical points. Danny Wei has spent his life pushing past obstruction. Skating gave him a family and a sense of belonging, and he feels strongly that the only way to honor that debt is to continue progressing his sport. To that point, the medical staff checks out his ankle. It's clearly destroyed. They tell him he needs to go to the hospital, that he should seriously consider calling it a day. Wei shakes his head against the idea.
"That's not my style," he says.
Thus,
Not much more than 10 minutes later, Wei returns to the top of the mega ramp, shakes off the pain, and throws a rocket air backflip over the gap. On its own, in his condition, just a rocket air would have been a victory. Invented by Christian Hosoi in 1986, the trick requires a skater to stand with both feet on the tail of the board, while both hands grip the nose, and then, by shoving the board forward, the skater and his board form the rough outline of a rocket. But adding a broken ankle and a backflip to this mix? It's the rough equivalent of Leonardo da Vinci painting the Mona Lisa with a steak knife shoved into his eye. That's part of the problem with trying to discuss the level of performance in action sports today, says Travis Pastrana. Danny Way did a 70-foot backflip on a broken ankle. But how many people in the world can even throw a backflip? On flat ground? Over a 70-foot gap? How about a rocket air? None of these are everyday skills. To put them together in front of a live audience, in gold medal competition? Most people would say that's a home run to win the World Series. But Danny wasn't even done. He still had the quarter pipe ahead of him. The quarter pipe throws Wei about 20 feet into the air, and Wei throws a varial 540, meaning at the same time that he's doing 1.5 spins, he's also reaching down between his legs and spinning his board 180 degrees. Then laces, comes in smooth, the landing. Pandemonium erupts. If ever you say you can't do something, shouts the announcer, remember Danny Way! But there's no need to remember, because Way isn't done. Over the next hour, he and Bernquist and Brown enter into one of the greatest duels in X Games history. In the middle of it, Way takes another fall, stunningly hard, but comes back a second time. He has one run left. To pull back into first place, he needs to pull off something spectacular. He does not disappoint. Way backflips over the gap and soars out of the quarter pipe and throws... Well, no one is still sure. He spins around twice and sails too far from the vert wall, then tries to alter his flight path by torquing sideways. This added momentum over-rotates his torso. His feet sail up toward his head. His body spins nearly upside down. He's 50 feet above the deck and falling fast. The announcer says, "Oh, no!" The entire stadium braces for impact. Then Wei, as calmly as a geisha pouring tea, sets his feet back on the board and stomps the landing. "I've been shooting action sports for 20 years, says photographer Mike Blayback. "I've never seen anyone do something like it." Not many have. It's been said that the 4-week stretch from Wei's first attempt at the Great Wall to the X Games landing of his 540 miracle is one of the most astounding examples of athletic performance in action sport history. Maybe, some say, the most astounding. Ultimately, it's probably too difficult to make such comparisons, but if nothing else, Wei's performance demonstrates the depth of our ignorance. We really have no idea how deep our reservoir runs. No clear estimate of where our limits lie. You want more proof? In the big air competition, Danny Way placed second. Bob Bernquist, on the last run of the contest, busts out a move he has yet to attempt, either in warm-ups or at any point during the contest. He goes switch over the gap and switch into the quarter pipe, then tosses an Indy backside 360 off the vert wall, one of the harder tricks in skateboarding. Ironically, it's a trick invented by Wei in the early 1990s. Landing one requires coming in backward and blind. Bernquist threw the biggest Indy backside 360 ever, falling more than 20 feet before the ramp snapped into view. Watching from the side, Wei just shakes his head and starts clapping. "Every good athlete can find the flow," continues Pastrana, "but it's what you do with it that makes you great. If you consistently use that state to do the impossible, you get confident in your ability to do the impossible. You begin to expect it. That's why we're seeing so much progression in action sports today. It's the natural result of a whole lot of people starting to expect the impossible. The Godfather of Flow. It was Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, the former chairman of the University of Chicago Department of Psychology and now at Claremont Graduate University, who first coined the term flow. This was in the late 1960s. Csikszentmihalyi was in the midst of what would soon become the largest global happiness study ever conducted, though this was a somewhat accidental outcome. To borrow Daniel Gilbert's phrase, Csikszentmihalyi had merely stumbled upon happiness. What he'd really been searching for was the meaning of life. It had been quite a search. Csikszentmihalyi was born in Fluma, Italy, which is now Rijeka, Croatia, on September 29, 1934. The son of a Hungarian diplomat, his childhood was war-torn, spent in flight from both the Nazis and the Russians. One of his brothers was killed, another exiled to Siberia. When he was 7 years old, Csikszentmihalyi was sent to an Italian prison camp. In the camp, Csikszentmihalyi learned to play chess. He became obsessed with the game. When at the board, nothing else seemed to penetrate his consciousness. No missing siblings, no armed guards, no prison he couldn't leave. Chess allowed him to forget the tumult, to make the best of a bad situation. This, he noticed, was something of a rare talent. In prison, Csikszentmihalyi told audiences at TED, I realized how few of the grown-ups around me were able to withstand the tragedies the war visited upon them, how few of them had anything resembling a normal, contented, satisfied life once their job, their home, and their security was destroyed. So I became interested in understanding what contributed to a life worth living. After the war, Csikszentmihalyi read philosophy, studied religion, got involved in the arts. All the things that supposedly gave life meaning. Nothing quite satisfied. Then, one Sunday afternoon in Zurich, he attended a free lecture by Carl Jung, the founder of analytical psychology. Csikszentmihalyi enjoyed the talk, started reading Jung's books, and pretty soon decided psychology was the best way to answer his question. In the coming years, his studies took him to the University of Chicago, where Csikszentmihalyi zeroed in on one of the hot topics of the time, motivation. After Freud's unconscious had been dethroned by Skinner's behaviorism, psychologists began having a hard time explaining why people did the things they did. The behaviorists said it all came down to need and reward. We do X to get Y. This is known as extrinsic motivation. But the conclusion never sat right with Abraham Maslow. One of the greatest psychological thinkers of the past century, Maslow began his career in the 1940s on staff at Brooklyn College, where he was mentored by anthropologist Ruth Benedict and Gestalt psychologist Max Wertheimer. Back then, most of psychology was focused on fixing pathological problems rather than celebrating psychological possibilities. But Maslow thought Benedict and Wertheimer such wonderful human beings that he began studying their behavior, trying to figure out what it was they were doing right. Over time, he began studying the behavior of other exemplars of outstanding human performance. Albert Einstein, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Frederick Douglass each came under his scrutiny. Maslow was looking for common traits and common circumstances, wanting to explain why these folks could attain such unbelievable heights while so many others continued to flounder. High achievers, he came to see, were intrinsically motivated. They were deeply committed to testing limits and stretching potential, frequently using intensely focused activity for exactly this purpose. But this focused activity, Maslow also noticed, produced a significant reward of its own. Altering consciousness, creating experiences very similar to those James had dubbed mystical. Except the key difference. Few of Maslow's subjects were even religious. So Maslow secularized James's terminology. Mystical experiences were out. Peak experiences were in. The sensation, though, was the same. During a peak experience, Maslow explained, the individual experiences an expansion of self, a sense of unity and meaningfulness in life. The experience lingers in one's consciousness and gives a sense of purpose, integration, self-determination, and empathy. These states, he concluded, were the hidden commonality among all high achievers, the source code of intrinsic motivation. The peak experience is felt as a self-validating, self-justifying moment. It is felt to be a highly valuable, even uniquely valuable experience. So great an experience sometimes that even to attempt to justify it takes away from its dignity and worth. As a matter of fact, so many people find this so great and high an experience that it justifies not only itself, but even living itself. Peak experiences can make life worthwhile by their occasional occurrence. They give meaning to life itself. They prove it to be worthwhile. To say this in a negative way, I would guess that peak experiences help to prevent suicide. Csikszentmihalyi arrived on the scene a few years later. The birth of his happiness study was a more pedestrian version of Maslow's inquiry. Csikszentmihalyi wasn't just interested in high achievers. He was curious about what motivated the average citizen. What activities produced their deepest enjoyment and greatest satisfaction? This was the birth of his happiness study, the desire to ask people about the times in their lives when they felt their best and performed at their best. He started out interviewing experts, rock climbers, dancers, artists, surgeons, chess players, and the like. Next, he expanded his search to include Italian farmers, Navajo sheepherders, Chicago assembly line workers, rebellious Japanese teenagers, elderly Korean women, a gargantuan assortment in total. Surprisingly, and regardless of culture, level of modernization, age, social class, or gender, all of these people told him the same thing. When they were at their best and felt their best was when they were experiencing sensations very similar to Maslow's peak experiences. This was a fairly startling finding. It meant that while the things people found enjoyable varied completely, the Japanese teenagers liked to swarm around on motorcycles, and the elderly Korean women preferred meditation. The feeling the activity produced, the why behind the enjoyment, was globally ubiquitous. In fact, when Csikszentmihalyi dove deeper into the data, he discovered that the happiest people on Earth, the ones who felt their lives had the most meaning, were those who had the most peak experiences. Moreover, this did not come down to chance or luck. The happiest people on Earth worked hard for their fulfillment. They didn't just have the most peak experiences, they had devoted their lives to having these experiences. Often, as Csikszentmihalyi explained in his 1996 book, Creativity, going to extreme lengths to seek them out. It was clear from talking to them that what kept them motivated was the quality of the experience they felt when they were involved with the activity. The feeling didn't come when they were relaxing, when they were taking drugs or alcohol, or when they were consuming the expensive privileges of wealth. Rather, it often involved painful, risky, difficult activities that stretched the person's capacity and involved an element of novelty and discovery. In his interviews, to describe these optimal states of performance, flow was a term his subjects kept using. When everything was going right, the work was effortless, fluid, and automatic. Flowy. So Csikszentmihalyi, in keeping with tradition, renamed peak experiences, instead calling them flow states. He defined the state as being so involved in an activity that nothing else seems to matter. The ego falls away. Time flies. Every action, movement, and thought follows inevitably from the previous one, like playing jazz. Your whole being is involved, and you are using your skills to the utmost. And those skills are significantly magnified. Physical skills, mental skills, psychological skills, social skills, creative skills, decision-making skills, the list goes on. A 10-year study done by McKinsey found top executives reported being up to 5 times more productive when in flow. Creativity and cooperation are so amplified that Greylock partner venture capitalist James Slavitt, in a recent article for Forbes.com, called flow state percentage, defined as the amount of time employees spend in flow, the most important management metric for building great innovation teams. Flow also has an incredible yet unsung impact on our economy. When we watch a live concert or a traditional sports event, says former head of innovation at Yahoo and Singularity University global ambassador Salim Ismail, we're essentially paying to watch people in a flow state. Whether it's Kobe Bryant, Roger Federer, Jay-Z, or a jazz crooner, they've all put in endless hours of work so that when performance time comes, they are fully present and in flow. An actor with screen presence is there too. A great poet can deliver flow to the reader just through the power of words. We pay to watch, read, or be in the presence of a flow experience. If quantified, you'd find it's a major chunk of the GDP. Of course, flow's effects extend beyond profits turned and abilities enhanced. The data Csikszentmihalyi collected was clear. Flow is more than an optimal state of consciousness, one where we feel our best and perform our best. It also appears to be the only practical answer to the question, what is the meaning of life? Flow is what makes life worth living. There are moments that stand out from the chaos of the everyday as shining beacons, wrote Csikszentmihalyi, alongside psychologist Susan Jackson in Flow in Sports. In many ways, one might say that the whole effort of humankind through millennia of history has been to capture these fleeting moments of fulfillment and make them part of everyday existence. Flow was a groundbreaking discovery, and one with considerable impact. In the coming years, it would quietly reshape our world, radically altering our thinking about everything from the limits of human performance to the neurobiology of religious experience. It would launch outstanding scientific debate and either wholly create or significantly impact a half dozen fields of academic research. Corporations like Patagonia, Toyota, Ericsson, and Microsoft would make flow a critical piece of their strategy and culture. Entire industries would benefit. Coders in flow built the internet. Gamers in flow built the video game industry. And, of course, the sports world has never been the same. For athletes hunting the zone, books and training programs appeared by the score. Flow in golf, flow in tennis, flow in archery. In 1993, coach Jimmy Johnson credited Csikszentmihalyi with helping the Dallas Cowboys win the Super Bowl. And suddenly, flow in football. Temple University sports psychologist Michael Sachs, who made an extensive study of these states, summed this up nicely. Every gold medal or world championship that's ever been won, most likely, we now know, there's a flow state behind the victory. Yet, out of all of these groups, it's action and adventure sport athletes who have taken things the farthest. Some of this was accidental, some intentional. But if you're looking for one reason why there has been near exponential growth in ultimate human performance over this past generation, the first thing to know is the most straightforward. While finding flow may be the goal of every athlete on the planet,
For action and adventure sports athletes, it's a necessity. In all other activities, flow is the hallmark of high performance. But in situations where the slightest error could be fatal, then perfection is the only choice, and flow is the only guarantee of perfection. Thus, flow is the only way to survive in the fluid, life-threatening conditions of big waves, big rivers, and big mountains. Without it, equipment like the mega ramp remain a pipe dream or a death sentence. Necessity, as they say, is the mother of invention. Or, as Danny Way explains, it's either find the zone or suffer the consequences. There's no other choice available. 2. The wave of flow. The millennium wave. In the annals of find the zone or suffer the consequences, there is little that can compare to chopu. The word translates from the French Polynesian as wall of skulls or place of severed heads, but neither description quite captures. Surfers describe chopu as hideous, deadly, a war zone, liquid napalm, the grinding eye of doom, and, of course, up there with anything for tons of brutality per square inch of skin. The website Surfline might have said it best. This isn't your father's perfect wave, and unless seeing your next birthday doesn't rank on your list of priorities, it isn't yours either. Chopu sits a quarter mile off the southwestern coast of Tahiti. It is not a cold water wave like California's Mavericks, nor a tall wave like Hawaii's Jaws. Instead of exploding vertically, chopu detonates laterally, producing a barrel that has accurately been compared to the Lincoln Tunnel. It is also the heaviest wave in the world, the most mass, the most power, the most ferocity. But unlike other famous big wave destinations, Jaws, Waimea Bay, Mavericks, chopu breaks in incredibly shallow water. Less than 3 feet below the surface of the water sits a razor-sharp coral reef. Surf legend Laird Hamilton summed up the issue nicely. Jaws is all about the hold down. Chopu is all about the bounce. And it was Hamilton who, on August 17th, 2000, just 7 days after surfer Bryce Teoria died from Chopu's bounce, tucked his feet into his foot straps, grabbed hold of a tow rope, and headed out to this famed lineup. Hawaiian big wave charger Derek Dorner was piloting that jet ski, and, considering what would soon unfold, this was perhaps appropriate. Some 8 years prior, Hamilton and Dorner had together made the discovery that made surfing chopu even possible. The issue was one of physics. Catching a wave requires paddling a surfboard to a speed roughly equal to the wave's speed. But big waves travel far faster than a human being can actually paddle. As a result, since the early days of surfing, waves in excess of 25 feet have been deemed uncatchable, thus unrideable. As author Susan Casey explained in The Wave, anything bigger is simply moving too fast. Trying to catch a 60-foot wave by windmilling away on your stomach is like trying to catch the subway by crawling. To get around this problem, in the mid-90s, Laird Hamilton, Derek Dorner, and Buzzy Kerbox invented the sport of toe-in surfing. Instead of having to paddle into monster waves, these surfers could hitch a ride on a tow line hung behind a jet ski. The ski could then whip the surfer into the wave with exacting precision and more than enough speed to catch the behemoth. The result was a paradigm shift akin to Danny Way's invention of the mega ramp. It meant that once off-limits monsters were suddenly open for business. And business was good. If you're looking for another example of the recent and accelerated progress in ultimate human performance, consider that Pat Curran's 1960 ride of a 25-footer at Waimea Bay had long been deemed the biggest wave ever caught. In 1996,
wrote surf historian Matt Warshaw in Surf Writers. Laird Hamilton caught the biggest wave of the year, a 35-footer. A 10-foot jump after 36 years doesn't seem like much. The fact that a full three-quarters of that height jump was made from 1993 to 1996, however, is nothing less than amazing. It was also just the beginning. Hamilton, Dorner, and Kerbox were soon joined by Dave Kalama, Brett Little, Rush Randall, Mark Angulo, Mike Waltz, Pete Cabrina, and Brian Keolana, an exceptional bevy of big wave talent who together formed the Strapped Crew, a reference to the foot straps used to hold these surfers on their boards. These men pioneered both toe-in surfing and the next phase of big wave rescue, an attempt to make the colossally dangerous merely exceptionally dangerous. Others soon borrowed their techniques, and by decade's end, waves in excess of 50 feet were being toyed with on a semi-regular basis. But nothing accomplished in the 1990s compared to the madness Dorner and Hamilton awoke to that sunny day in 2000. When both men got to the beach, the surf was big. Too big. "The day started out with us being told Chopu was completely unrideable," recounts Hamilton. "They said, 'We don't go out there when it's like this.' But all the people who do what we do, who do things that no one has done before, we're not the type to accept that answer. All no means is they don't know for sure, or there's a secret being kept, like someone's trying to hide something really good. Either way, we have to try." And by "we," he means, of course, himself. Hamilton grew up in Hawaii. His adopted father, Bill Hamilton, considered the most stylish surfer of his era, had no problem taking his son to the beach. At the time, the beach was the legendary Banzai Pipeline, one of the more vicious breaks in surfing. But Pipeline was Bill's playground. Thus it became Laird's as well. "People always ask me if I feel fear in the big waves. Of course I'm afraid. If I was out in 50-foot surf and I'm not feeling fear, then I'm not properly assessing the situation. But it's different when you're raised in these conditions. When I was a kid, I was rescued every 4 or 5 days at Pipeline. The currents would catch me and drag me out, and the lifeguards would have to come get me. Eventually, they got so pissed off, they told my father to lock me up while he surfed." Little has changed. When it comes to the questionable edge of big waves, even among his exceptionally talented group of friends, Hamilton has remained, as he puts it, the crash test dummy. In this particular case, he had an early morning session riding beastly Chopu, and no problem. He loved every minute. So the rest of the crew went out to see for themselves. That session went well. After his friends had their fill, Hamilton decided he wanted another go. His timing couldn't have been better. Or worse. Right when he grabbed the tow rope to begin his second session, the real heart of the swell arrived. "Imagination," says futurist and philosopher Jason Silva, "allows us to conceive of delightful future possibilities, pick the most amazing one, and pull the present forward to meet it." But the wave that Hamilton chose, it wasn't a future anyone wanted to meet. Dorner, from his position on the ski, saw what was about to happen and tried to shout Hamilton out of the way. Others did as well. Even before what is now known as the Millennium Wave rose anywhere close to its final height, a chorus of "Don't go!" erupted from surfers and spectators sitting in the channel. But it was too late. Hamilton was already gone. The Millennium Wave was a rogue wave. A freakish titan, the product of two different swells intersecting and stacking atop each other. The results looked less like a product of hydrodynamics than a very special effect cooked up by wizards in Hollywood. "On any normal wave," says Matt Warshaw, "the lip, the part that is pitching ahead and forming the tube, is only a tiny fraction of the wave. On the Millennium Wave, it was almost half. It was like a dam bursting, like someone had dropped the seafloor by 30 feet and the ocean was desperately trying to find level ground. So much force was being generated that Hamilton, as he was trying to get into position for the tube ride, found himself getting sucked up the wave's face. To hold steady, he had to reach down to the outside of his surfboard and drag his right hand in the water. It was the perfect move, and the only reason he's alive today. But here's the thing. No one had ever made that move before. Laird had to drag his backhand, says former surfer editor Sam George in Stacy Peralta's film Riding Giants, on the opposite side of the board to keep himself from getting sucked up in that hydraulic. In the middle of that maelstrom, how did his mind say this is what I have to do? No one had ever ridden as Laird rode on that wave before. He couldn't practice. So it was his imagination dealing with that unimaginable energy and coming up with the plan spontaneously. And then things got really crazy. That monster lip cantilevered into the reef, and the resulting thunderclap splash went off like a megaton bomb. Shockwaves pulsed into the channel. The spray shot up almost 60 feet. As far as anyone could tell, Hamilton had been swallowed whole. Seconds later, though, the mists parted, and out he rode, tall and triumphant. It is no exaggeration to say nothing has been the same since. Laird's wave at Chopu was the single most significant ride in surfing history, continues George. More than any other ride, what it did was completely restructure our entire collective perception of what was possible. Or, at least, that's how the history books tell the story. The real truth is even more peculiar. We don't talk about it much because of the film and all the press attention that followed, explains Hamilton. But I rode two other waves that day that were bigger than the Millennium Wave. One of them had boat wakes running through it. So not only was it bigger, but just to mess with my mind a little more, I had to jump these little rollers as I was riding down the face. I am trying to free your mind, Neo. By now, it should come as no surprise that Hamilton found himself in a flow state while riding those Chopu waves. Flow tends to be the psychic signature of world-class performance and paradigm-shifting breakthroughs, and clearly Hamilton's effort falls into both categories. Moreover, as Danny Way pointed out, there's just no other way to survive such a situation. But the goal of part one of this audiobook is to understand how flow makes these things possible. So these facts don't take us very far. Instead, to get at the answers we want, we're going to need to draw a much more detailed map of the experience. Flow cartography begins in the brain. Of course it does. To paraphrase author Diane Ackerman, that little huddle of neurons calls all the plays. But how it calls a play, like flow, is a complicated affair. The brain sends messages, that is, calls plays, electrically and chemically, and both are important here. Moreover, where in the brain these messages are being sent further affects the experience. So to complete our map of flow, we need to understand how the state impacts neuroelectricity, later in this chapter, neuroanatomy, chapter 3, and neurochemistry, chapter 4. Yet, before we can answer these specific questions, we must first address a few general concerns. For starters, why are we examining events like the Millennium Wave? After all, many of us will never surf a day in our lives, let alone paddle into anything nearly as fearsome as Chopu. But that doesn't mean we have nothing to learn. Action and adventure athletes have used flow to push performance faster and farther than any group in history. So their triumphs can become our teachers. These events are our yardsticks, so we can see what's actually achievable, and case studies, so we can figure out how to achieve similar heights. The point is not that the impossible is possible for these athletes alone,
If we diligently apply the lessons detailed herein, it's actually possible for all of us. Our next general concern is the definition of terms. What is flow, exactly? Scientists describe it either as a state of consciousness or an altered state of consciousness, though neither phrase completely satisfies. Consciousness itself is a slippery subject. There is no agreed-upon definition of the term, nor accurate taxonomy of its various states. Traditionally, researchers divide consciousness into sleeping, waking, and dreaming, then further subdivide by degrees of focus and alertness. The results are a progression of attentional categories from the total unresponsiveness of a vegetative coma to the hypervigilance of the fight-or-flight response. Flow states fall on this scale, but not exactly. The zone requires attention, but of a very specific kind. When it comes to the task at hand, concentration is nearly total. Laird Hamilton saw every nuance of detail of the Millennium Wave's face. Yet, beyond this field, his awareness dropped off precipitously. That is, he never heard the cries of warning coming from the spectators in the channel. Hamilton was hypervigilant and totally unresponsive, and both at the same time. So unlike most other states of consciousness, which are defined by a singular type of attention, flow breaks boundaries, straddling multiple categories at once. Nor does flow fit comfortably into the standard definition of an altered state of consciousness, which, using psychologist Charles Tart's classic description, is a qualitative shift in the pattern of mental functioning. The issue is that most of these shifts are emotionally unstable. While sleeping, we have good dreams and bad dreams. While taking psychedelics, we have good trips and bad trips. Flow, on the other hand, is always a positive experience. No one ever has a bad time in a flow state. So while the zone provides a qualitative shift in mental functioning, it's a far more consistent shift than can be found in other altered states of consciousness. Consider, for example, how Hamilton describes the experience of riding giants, be they at Chopu or otherwise. When you're in that moment, there's no beginning and no end. It starts off where it left off. When you go to that place, there's no time, and there's definitely no thought. It's just pure. You are, and it is, and that's why we continually seek it out, and always search for it, and need it. We need it to feel alive, and to feel complete, and to bring it all into perspective. It just makes everything else fall in line, fall in place. It makes everything else tolerable. In his words, we hear plenty of familiar echoes. Just like Haim, Hamilton experienced time dilation. Just like Danny Way, he vanished into the moment. The same intrinsic motivation that fascinated Maslow shows up, as does Csikszentmihalyi's meaning of life ramifications. So while flow might be different from both traditional and altered states of consciousness, the stability of these component parts allows us to zero in on the phenomena. To do just that, let's pry deeper into Hamilton's tale. Here's his memory of the takeoff. I remember letting go of the rope just as Double D, a.k.a. Derek Dorner, yelled out, "Don't let go!" And other people were shouting, "Don't go! Don't go!" I remember seeing the magnitude of the wall as it stood up, a double wall, and then putting myself in position. And then time just stood still. Then it was like I had an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other as I thought about what I should do next, and they were saying, "Jump off! Stay on! Jump off! Stay on!" Eventually the angel won, and I stayed on. And that's the only way I made it. Within this experience, we discover three of the more curious and basic properties of flow. The profound mental clarity provided by the state. Note the calm, rational nature of the mental argument. The emotional detachment that tends to accompany this clarity.